Well, let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for our time together this evening, and we pray that as we consider these topics before us this evening, as we think about the latter half of the 19th century, as we see the way in which you have led your people, but also some of the challenges faced and some of the missteps along the way, that you would give us wisdom to understand this setting then, and also to understand how it applies and helps us understand where we are now. Amen. So here we are, week 12. That's very impressive, isn't it? Week 12. Snappily titled, The Later 19th Century. So you should have a handout. A mere 8 pages, is that right? 10? Oh, well, there you go. Okay. So, the goal tonight is to do a little bit on the politics of this period. Really big overview stuff, just to give us a bit of a handle on what's going on. Then to spend a little bit of time looking at what's happening with non-conformity, that's sort of, you know, non-Anglicanism around mid-century, and what's happening with what happens with Roman Catholicism in Europe in that period, just to give us a bit of a sense, because most of our time, most of our attention is what's happening on in Anglicanism. And then we'll look at theological liberalism, which will be take us a little bit of a while to tease through, impact into the 19th century, all very slightly depressing. But don't worry, we're finishing with J.C. Ryle, so it'll be all right in the end. Okay? Does that sound okay? That's the plan for tonight. So whatever you do, don't go with about 25 minutes left, because you'll just leave depressed, because we won't have got to J.C. Ryle. So there we are. So just to begin with the politics, you should have your sheet on your front. I've written Chartism and given you a date for the Charter. And the reason I start here is just to give you a bit of a snapshot of what the political situation is at this period. So there are 6 demands that the Chartists make. Anybody know and remember any of them? No? Okay. It's the kind of thing you might have learned at school, you never know. They want a universal male suffrage. Male suffrage, obviously. Yeah. Not be silly. So universal male suffrage, let's not ask for the earth. They want the abolition of the property qualification for MPs. At this point, MPs had to hold a certain property amount of property because they had to be in a debate. It was a way of saying that they were in good standing in order to be MPs. They wanted to get rid of that qualification. They wanted annual parliaments. Aren't we glad they didn't get that? They wanted electoral districts of equal sizes, which is a somewhat revolutionary idea. At this point, you've got differences between shire seats and borough seats, and therefore it's not like now where every electoral district is roughly the same size or gets reorganised with regular intervals. They thought MPs ought to be paid, because of course if they're not paid and you can't afford to be an MP, then that penalises you. And they thought the ballot should be secret, rather than the electorate turning up on polling day and declaring to the returning officer who they were voting for publicly. They thought that there should be a secret ballot. 2 things serve as though. That just tells you where political climate was in 1838. It also, 5 of those 6 were achieved over the next 100 years. Obviously, and thankfully, annual parliaments. Because can you imagine going through that every June? It would be a bit of a nightmare, wouldn't it? It's bad enough every couple of years. Hello, come and join us. You might have to sit near the front, I'm afraid. That's your penalty. Thank you for coming. So that's Chartism. And then we go through really some things that are all about the formation of modern political parties. Remember, through this, I've kind of said, talked about Whigs and Tories and said, look, don't equate that with liberals and conservatives. They're not quite the same. Well, from this period, from the middle of the 19th century, you can talk about the Liberal Party and mean pretty much what it meant in the 20th century. And you can talk about the Conservative Party and mean something similar to what we know of from the 20th century. So I've given you a few things there on the sheet. The repeal of the Corn Laws by Robert Peel. The Corn Laws were a set of protections on the price of corn. They were very complicated, but what they basically meant is that the price of corn was protected in England against foreign imports. It was a result of the Napoleonic Wars. During the Napoleonic Wars, a lot of land that was fairly marginal had been farmed because it was difficult to import food from outside. And therefore, once the Napoleonic Wars had finished and that land becomes And you can start importing. It's cheaper to import grain from abroad than it. So that's what it is. It's classic protectionism. Robert Peel, who's a Tory, repeals that against his party, okay? Because the Tory landowning party generally are in favour of the Corn Laws. But of course, the Corn Laws are unpopular with lots of people in the country because if you inflate and keep the price of corn high, then you also... Yeah, you keep the price of bread high, don't you? So you can, and you know, by this period there's an anti-corn law league, and it's big politics. You know, Robert Peel didn't need to do that; his party would have stayed in power, but he did that, and that starts shifting the political situation mid 19th century. Give me the Irish potato famine: 1 million deaths, 1 million emigrations. Population of Ireland falls 20% between 1841 and 1851. And one of the issues with that, although it's not the sole issue, is that some in England, one, don't realise the scale of the problem, really, but also subscribe to Malthusian economics. Okay, Malthusian economics, named after a guy named Malthus, who basically said, you need to let the system find its level. And therefore, if there is overpopulation in Ireland, which arguably there was in the mid-19th century, the population of Ireland was higher then than it is now, then you leave nature to take its course, okay? Which is rather brutal when that means a million people die and a million people... Now, I don't think anyone quite realised it was going to be quite like that, and that is one of the things that starts another big feature of the 19th century, second half, which is the Irish question. Someone quoted to me from 1066 and all that, something like the 1066 and all that summary of the Irish question is to say, during the 19th century... every time the English thought they'd solved the Irish question, they discovered that the question had changed. And whilst that's slightly pejorative, it's not an awful summary. There's so many elements to the question that's a big feature of politics in the 19th century. So in this period, the modern Liberal Party is formed. That's a mixture of those old aristocratic Whigs from the 17th century, and the radicals, who wouldn't look very radical now, but those who are pushing for the kind of things that you might find in Chartism and those kind of ideas, and the Peelites, those who followed Robert Peel. So you get what you can really talk about the modern Liberal Party. And at this period, the Liberal Party is mid-century, really, is the party of power. Okay, with that grouping, that's a pretty effective grouping. Really, in response to that, and in response to changes in the electorate, you get the formation of the modern Conservative Party in 1867. So you can talk about the Conservatives from that point onwards. And I've given you the details of the Reform Bill. We talked about the Reform Bill in 1832. This is 1867. New seats are created. The electorate is increased from a fifth to two-fifths of men, obviously. There's another smaller reform bill in 1872. But the big significance of 1867 is now, really, politics are beyond elite control in the way they used to be. When you've got a comparatively small electorate, particularly in some of the shires, and everybody knows everybody else, and it's a public ballot, i.e. it's not a secret ballot, then it's not that hard to actually exercise influence over who gets elected. And before the date of the election, you can have pretty good confidence of how it's going to go, because your man is going to vote that way, and his men who work for him are also going to vote that way, frankly, and all the rest of it. That kind of situation. Well, obviously, once you keep increasing the size of the electorate, you can't work politics in that way. So that's growth of modern politics. You then get three key figures: Gladstone, Disraeli, and Salisbury. Gladstone, who's a liberal, Disraeli, who's a conservative, Salisbury, who's a conservative as well. And a number of things happen here that impact the church. The Church of Ireland is disestablished in 1869. So that raises the question as to whether the church in England will be disestablished too. Obviously, there's a particular logic about disestablishing the church in Ireland because of the situation there. Continuing problems in Ireland, By the 1870s, a lot of those problems were over land ownership. Who owns it? Is it being exploited? So on and so forth. And then I've given you some dates from the 1880s. Franchises extended 1884. There's a bill for new constituencies in town. And by now, two-thirds of men can vote. 8 million electors out of 45 million in the whole of the UK. Well, two-thirds of men.
We haven't got to.
Well, and to be fair, it's not really Pankhurst. It's the other ones. The more throwing yourself in front of the king's horse doesn't really do a lot for electoral reform. It's more the 1897 and the formation of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies. They're the ones that actually get suffrage through in the end. It's just that Pankhurst fits more happily into our world, doesn't it, where we want a sensational story. A complicated, slow-burning process doesn't make good headlines. Yes, and of course there's lots of children in there as well, because you've got a growing population, therefore you've got a lot of people under the age of 18. So that would make roughly 12 million men, 12 million women, and about 20 million under the age of 18, which is probably about right, actually, in the late 19th century. Well, no, not birth, and also you've got an expanding population. Expanding population tends to mean more children. Child mortality rates are still high. I don't even know, I'd have to check whether 18 is the age, or might even be 21 that's the age of a majority for elections. But that's the kind of thing. That's why it doesn't add up. But good question. Then Gladstone decides that he's going to support Home Rule, and that basically divides the Liberal Party. And really, that's it for the Liberal Party, because it doesn't really do a lot of ruling after that. And then what is it? When's the last Liberal government? Is it before into the First World War, isn't it? I always get my dates wrong with them. So over 100 years ago. So having been the party of power in the mid-19th century, really, after 1886... and the coalition, if you like, that the Liberal Party is. And of course, another factor in that is the formation of the Labour Party, which grows dramatically in the early part of the 20th century, takes a lot of the votes away from the Liberal Party. And that's a big shift. And I've given you the formation of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Society. So this is starting to be a growing desire in the late 19th century, along with other recognition of other rights that women needed in a changing political and social landscape. And then I've just given you a whole load of stuff what happened in this period, just to give you a bit of a feel for social change. Poor houses are improved. Poor houses come in the 1830s as a result of the Poor Law. The Poor Law is originally intended to be the idea of the Poor Law is that you really have to be destitute to take advantage of it. That if anyone could work, they would, rather than being a poorhouse. That's the original intention. There are improvements made later on. First department store, 1870. 13,000 miles of railway track laid by 1870. I was very disappointed this morning, because I asked the question as to whether there were still 13,000 miles of railway track, and no one in the room, which surprised me, could give me an exact figure for how much railway track there is laid in the United Kingdom. I suspect it might be less than 13,000 miles, given the number of branch lines that got ripped up after the Second World War, because the 1870s, 80s and 90s is peak rail, isn't it? This is the point where rail is the best means of transport, the quickest. It's always the quickest that wins. 1871, trade unions legalised, various things, public health acts, but notice still 80% of land is owned by 7,000 people in 1873. And that's important then, more important than it would be now, because land is still wealth and power in 1870, less so in 1970 or now. Chain stores, compulsory education, rights to women, and Victoria rules 400 million people inhabiting a fifth of the globe in 1890. And I've given you the population figures from the 1851 census through to 1911. 1851 census is the first time we really get
good, accurate figures that you can have confidence with. That's why 1851 gets quoted so much. But then after that, you've got good census figures. What you can see there is actually compared to what we saw, say, between 1750 and 1850, the population doesn't grow proportionally as much, but you're still going from 27.5 to 42 million people, which is a significant impact. And that's partly to do with improved living conditions, people living longer, and just a higher birth rate. Yeah. Well, like most red bricks, it's probably late 19th century, isn't it? I would imagine. Yeah, I imagine most. Yeah, most. Once you move outside.
I'm thinking about the population. Who can afford to take that sort of education?
Well, this is the period when it starts to be happening. So university, expanding the university sector beyond Oxford, Cambridge and a couple of others is a second half of the 19th century thing.
Yeah.
So that's when you start to get the big, and you can tell it's that because of where they are. So where are the red brick universities? If you think about where they are, they're in Lancaster, Liverpool, Manchester, Nottingham, Sheffield, Leeds. Well, it's not red brick because it's not a modern university. Those are all manufacturing. You know, those are all towns that they're industrial areas, aren't they? So, you know,
Birmingham.
You know, that's not a comprehensive list, but Bristol, it's a manufacturing area. You know, so you could tell that they must be founded in the 19th century because otherwise those towns are not of as much significance in the 17th century. Or in the 18th century as they are in the 19th. You know, particularly a place like Manchester. Manchester is, even in 1750, there's not a huge amount of it, but by 1850, it's a massively important town.
But coming back to railways, you've only just joined the two Manchester stations along that.
Well, yeah, you get to a point, don't you? No, I will not grumble about Crossrail at this point. There's lots of other things I just want to give you a bit of a flavour for the period. Obviously that has an impact on the church in terms of continuing changes, but I think probably social change wise you've got more stability in the Victorian period than in the sort of late 18th century period, where you've got all that shift from the population shifting from being rural to cities. You know, places are big. So this is the period where Manchester and Liverpool put public health systems in place, and suddenly they become places that are actually quite nice to live in, rather than, you know, places that are actually very difficult to live in. You know, drive through the middle of Liverpool. It's a little bit of a ghost town in places now, but drive through the middle of Liverpool, particularly on the south side, and there's a lot of very nice 19th century architecture, some rather grand properties there. Not all of them are grand now, but some very grand stuff. And you can see that with the, and obviously Liverpool, because it was an older city, because it was slave trade money as well, and maritime money grew earlier than a place like Manchester. Anyway, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Derby in this period, Derby's originally a railway town, isn't it, in terms of its growth?
1830s, 1836,
yeah. 1870. Yeah, so it's a railway town, and then the other industry follows on. So Rolls-Royce would have been first here in the
1908-9.
So that's, you know, so again, you can chart that, can't you? So there you go. So that's where we're at. Any other questions on that? That's just general flavour. So what's nonconformity look like in this period? By nonconformity, we mean anyone who's not an Anglican, okay? Because they are non-conformists, they are not conforming, they're not doing what they should, okay? They're being naughty, they're non-conformists. And I just want to go through the groups, and we've talked about most of this before, so just this is a sort of refresher. So Methodists, obviously Methodists, they're the biggest group of non-conformists by the middle of the 19th century, but there's various strands within Methodism, so there's, you know, we've got Methodists, Primitive Methodists and Calvinistic Methodists listed, so there's various strands.
Obviously, they're new. That's a new denomination, only been around for 100 years. It's a product of the revivals, product of Wesley, and so forth. Tend to be politically conservative with a small c. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, I think, well, when we were last here, because of the focus on the improvement of morals and how you're living, rather than changing the exterior political world. It's an interior world. Where do you get Methodism? Midland cities, West Riding of Yorkshire, the Southwest, big Methodist area, still is today. Durham and the mining communities there. Farm labourers in Lancashire. The interesting thing about Methodism is it's never an even national spread. So you'll get places where there just isn't a lot of Methodism around, but you'll get places where there's a lot because of that kind of thing. So how many Methodist churches did Belpy used to have? Can you tell me? About eight. That's pretty good coverage. Yep. Well, it's actually better than that, and I'll come on to why in a few minutes' time. And we'll come on to that a little bit later as well. No, you're all right. The thing about Methodists is a lot of Methodists would be categorised as lower middle class professions or artisans. Now, the lower middle class. Lower middle class is always an interesting group sociologically because it's a very difficult group and no one ever wants to stay there. Okay? If you are in a lower middle class, you want to be something different. And let me illustrate this in this way. What are the classic middle class professions? That's an artisan. You're not having tailor. Professions. Not working with your hands, principally. Middle class. Better. Go higher. Those are lower middle class. No, middle class. Middle class. Solicitor. We'll have a solicitor. Come on. What does everybody want their children to be?
Doctor.
There we go.
An accountant.
Doctor. Banker. Lawyer. Okay, possibly teacher. It just depends. It depends on which category of teacher you're dealing with. But those are so. Classic lower middle class professions would be things like bookkeepers. Okay, some school teachers. Clerical, but not at the rank of. And you know how that works. If that's your profession, if you're a doctor, you're probably perfectly happy if your son or daughter becomes a doctor. If you're a bookkeeper, you probably want your child to go up in the world and get into one of those better professions. That's a generalisation. It's not everybody, not how everybody works, but that's why I use that to illustrate what you talk about with lower middle class. Lower middle class is generally a category of people who are trying to lift themselves up and improve themselves. There's nothing wrong in that. It's not a criticism, but it's just an observation that therefore it's quite a fluid group. But also you get a lot of social movement. And because that's a big group within Methodism, through the 19th century, you can start chart a lot of social movement as there is improvement within, what one generation does this, the next generation does better. And so you can chart that progress through. Whereas, once you've got people in a professional situation, if they're professionals and they're doctors, and then their child's a doctor, and their child's a doctor, and their child's a doctor, that's great, but that's not movement socially, is it? Because you're still not owning stacks of land, which is how you get to the next rung up. That makes sense? It's very broad brush stuff, but that's just an observation on lower middle class. Well, that too. I mean, the other side of it from the 19th century perspective. Yeah. The other side, of course, from the 19th century perspective is that if you're in that lower middle class category, you're much more vulnerable to losing what you've got than if you're higher up the rungs. So shopkeepers would be in there and a lot of those kind of professions. So they are much more vulnerable. Doctors, lawyers, bankers tend to be all right. Well, that exactly in that category, working class. So that's yeah, you get a lot of that. You get a lot of lower middle class. You get a lot of artisans.
But you do also get, so you've got, depending on where you've got a lot of miners and certain things. But what you do find is that the primitive Methodists, founded 1811, they are much more, in the 19th century, more likely to be dealing with the working classes, partly because the result of Methodism from the 18th century is uplift. So if your family becomes Methodist in 1750, when you're artisans, miners, if you're clean living and godly and work with other Methodists and look after yourself, don't spend your time and your money on gin, then you're likely to be in a better position socially 60 years later, all broad brush stuff, 60 years later than the alternative. So Methodism becomes less working class as a result of people being Methodists, and also some change in social stuff, which is why the primitive Methodists founded in 1811, the clue's in the title, isn't it? They're trying to return to the primitive roots of Methodism, which is street preaching and reaching out to the working class. So it's noticeable amongst churches, an observable movement in churches, that because churches tend to be places of self-improvement in general terms, okay, and churches that are successful at reaching out to the working class can look two generations later to have been unsuccessful, because those children of working class people aren't working class anymore. And therefore you need to say, oh right, okay, our social setup has changed. A classic example of that would be some Anglican churches that are in historically quite working class areas, but the makeup of the church starts to look very different. And eventually what happens is everybody moves out but still goes to the church. So you then get, and then you have to address that issue. Anyone ever gone to one of those sort of churches? You know, the church itself might be in the nicest place in the edge of a town or part of in the suburbs, but the people who go to it, because their family have already been there, always been there, of basically a higher social class in broad brush terms than the local area. It's one of the things. And we beat ourselves up about that, but sometimes you just have to recognise it's partly because of the way that things have worked well. Anyway, so that's primitive Methodist. Calvinistic Methodist is exactly what it says on the tin. So remember that not all Methodists follow Wesley. Not all Methodists are Arminians. You've got those who followed Whitfield. You've got those, particularly in Wales, you've got a lot of Calvinistic Methodists. And you've got Lady Huntingdon's connection. Do you remember Lady Huntingdon's connection? That would fit in here. 44,000 still in 1851. Baptists, you've got general Baptists that tend to be Arminian, and particular Baptists who are Calvinist. Then other groups are quite small by 1851. There's not many Quakers left. If you look at the figures on that table, there's only 22,000. There's not much in the way of Presbyterians. They've mostly become Unitarians. That's 50,000 of them. And there are 1.2 million independent churches, which would be old Congregationalist churches from the 17th and 18th century. But if you look at where that goes, they're actually quite vulnerable to changes. So we come to this lovely little table at the bottom, which I did for you. I had great fun. I found on Google Books the report. So the government conducted a census in England and Wales of attendance at religious services on the 30th of March 1851. Reports were collected from local ministers who reported attendance at their services. So, whether it's accurate or not. The count was 10,896,066 out of a population of 17.9. That is the population of England and Wales, is 17.9 million. The total population of the UK is 27 million. That doesn't mean you've got 10 million people living in Scotland. It means you've got about 3 million in Scotland and about 7 million in Ireland, roughly.
What are the two courts?
Right, so all I've done is I've subdivided Wesleyan, Primitive and Calvinistic Methodists, but then put them all together at the end. It's total. Just so you can see the big picture, a small picture. No, not at all. Yes. So let's go through these groups then, okay? So you've got that's, you've got Anglicans and nonconformists in 1689. Just, let's start there. That means you have got two other groups, big groups at stake. You've got Baptist churches, the biggest distinction being that they do not believe in the baptism of children, they only believe in outward baptism. Some of those are Congregationalist, that is, they are governed, self-governing, not connected to other churches. Some of them are part of some kind of union over time, Baptist Union or whatever, various groupings. Okay. You also have some other Congregationalist churches, and you have some other independent churches, Presbyterians, but they disappear quite quickly in England. So that's your, but that's your Baptist and your Congregationalist. So that's your Baptist, your independence. Then, of course, Methodism is a product of the revivals of the 1740s, and has that all the way through into the early 19th century, has that sort of slightly on-off relationship with Anglicanism. There are some within Methodism that view Methodism as a way of doing things, not as a separate denomination. They are Methodists. They follow a certain standard of living, and they're perfectly happy to stay within Anglicanism. There are others who want to form a new denomination. That tension, you know, is eventually resolved by this period by the identification of separate Methodist churches. Okay, how are they different from Anglicans? Well, they vary, and because they're never, the distinction between Anglicanism and Methodism isn't as clearly defined theologically as, say, the distinction between a Baptist church and an Anglican church. So that's part of the reason it becomes a complicated question. But basically, you've got the Methodists have moved outside of the established church because they've wanted to have their own ministers who aren't Anglican ministers. They're wanting to run their own circuits and organise themselves outside the structures of bishops and the government and all the sort of chaos, as you know yourselves, that can be the Anglican patronage system. All right. So that's part of it. So it is quite difficult to say straightforwardly, there's a massive theological distinction. Generally, a Methodist in 1850 would be more visibly committed to their faith and working that out in their lives than an Anglican in 1850. It's a big generalisation, but I think I'm happy to stand by it. Because you've still got that, you know, newness and that this is who we are. Does that sort of answer the question? And then the others, so let's go down these others. Quakers is Quakers, or the Friends, Society of Friends. They are a 17th century denomination that focuses on listening and listening for the Spirit. So they have meetings where people will sit quietly until the Spirit speaks. Okay, by 1851, very small, 22,000.
But that was spread over the greater range of the round trees in the Canterbury's up there, the Quakers, presumably.
Well, you get Quakers everywhere, but they're very...
They work right the way down the bottom of the surface, as it were, they would be Quakers too, but it followed right the way down the
social maker.
Social.
I don't know, if I'm honest. I really don't know. Yeah. Don't know enough about Quakers. It's sort of small.
I mean, they're not lonely, working for the Quakers.
Yeah, I think that's probably a bit of that. But, you know, I think the thing to notice is just how, you know, compare that to Methodism, which didn't exist a century previously. You're 100 times more likely to meet a Methodist than a Quaker. Unitarians obviously don't believe in the Trinity. So like the Church of the Latter-day Saints, that is the Mormons, they are not really a Christian denomination, but they're in the figures. Moravians, that's a historical denomination originally from Moravia and influenced on Wesley. Isolated congregations, I never had a chance to find exactly what the distinction between isolated congregations and independents is. It's probably a classification of things we're not sure where else to put. But the big... I think Jehovah's Witnesses are later than this. I think they're late 19th century, early 20th century phenomenon. The big thing to notice is quite how many people are knocking up who are attending church. So more than half the population of England and Wales are at church on the 30th of March. Okay, that's a lot. It's not like that today. I don't
don't think it was, actually. I checked, it didn't look like it was Easter. But even if it was Easter, still pretty impressive. If you did these figures for Duffield, okay, 5,000 people in Duffield, all right, so let's say 60% are rocking up at church, which is 3,000 people, that will mean we will have 1,500 people here on Easter Sunday, okay? Well, I just, you know, that's, I doubt we will have 1,500 people here on Easter Sunday. It would also mean that the Methodist church would have 750 people, and across the other churches in Duffield, there would be about another 500. Okay? The only church that might be slightly less at might be the Roman Catholic Church as a proportion of population. So this is a figure. It's quite interesting. I find this census interesting just in terms of saying where churches are. I think the thing to say about it might well be kind of peak oil as far as church attendance is concerned. We're not quite so sure what it was like before, but this may well be, the mid-19th century may but well be about the best it ever got in terms of church attendance. Because you've got the impact of the evangelical revivals, you've got a lot of positive impact stuff through this period, both in Anglicanism and outside Anglicanism. It means you've got people coming to church. And I think if you chart the figures from here, they're basically downward. Yeah, and also you've got the social expectations. So particularly for attending an Anglican church, there is a social expectation that you will.
Yeah.
So that doesn't mean everybody who is really wants to be there.
Yeah,
there's that too. But I make the assumption that most people who come on a Sunday, that everyone who comes to St. Albans on Sunday morning basically chooses to, or the family chooses to, and would in principle want to. I doubt my ability to compel. Whereas in here, if you've got a kind of social this is the socially acceptable thing to do, then there are you have a category of people that go to church because they ought to. They don't want to, but they ought to. So there's good and bad about these figures, but I'm still, on the whole, I'd take them. Quite.
What about Hindus, Muslims, and all the other?
Well, at this point, so small, there is a figure. I think it's around about, it's a few thousand. There was a figure. I don't think it's quite included. There was a figure I found somewhere, but it's not huge numbers. Very small. We didn't tend on, with some notable exceptions, we didn't tend to bring slavery home. So we tended to keep it at arm's length and do it elsewhere. Which means that the real influx of those of Afro-Caribbean descent or of Asian descent is post Second World War. That's the really big influxes. There's some exceptions to that, but most of those communities don't go back more than three or four generations in terms of in the UK. You'd have bits and bobs. So I don't know when the first Hindu temple is built. Obviously, there is a degree of religious toleration at this point because Disraeli is Jewish. I mean, he converts, he becomes an Anglican in order to, but he, you know, everybody knows really. So that's his descent. But it's just such small populations. Those are much more of a spread because they've been around for longer, so it's much more of a spread, and often older Baptist churches you'll often find in slightly out of the way places, and I think that's related to rules
in the 17th century about how close, if you were rejected in Church of England, how close you were able to go to the parish church in order to preach. So there's a Baptist church, that's quite a big Baptist church back in Cheshire that I knew of, that we worked with, called Wheelock Heath. Now Wheelock Heath is little hamlet, pretty much, but that was the Baptist church had 120-130 congregation, because that was the one, and it just happened to be in a slightly out of the way place. So you often get that phenomenon, but yeah, much more of a general spread. A lot London as well. London would be a good hunting ground for the older congregate, the older dissenting or nonconformist denominations. Dissenters, nonconformists, same group of people. Okay. Any more questions on that? I'll give you a bit of a flavour. Is that quite good for? And the big headline figures is loads of Anglicans still, but look at those Methodists from nowhere to 2.7 million. That's pretty impressive in 100 years. And you see Roman Catholicism very small. It grows from that period, but it's shrinking back down towards that number now. Anybody want to be slightly depressed? Figures for 2014 Anglican church attendance? Anybody know what they are? Go on, have a guess. No, don't look yet. Gives you a percentage.
Sorry.
Anybody want to guess?
A million.
No, 660,000. 2014. We were at a million, but a few years ago. The graph is still going down slowly, bottoming out. Somebody told me, quoted the Church Time headline, which said, basically said, it's another year of bad figures, and says, cathedrals holding their own, which meant they hadn't dropped as much, so that was worth celebrating.
Do you know what the totals are, curious? An equivalent of all the
applications? Yeah, that is, if you look on your... I've given you it somewhere, I think. It's quite a long way, lot further on. The total figure for 2014, I did have a look, is somewhere on your handout. You said bottom page 4. No, bottom page 5. So I've given you the percentages. I've given you the percentage for 1851, 20% Anglican, 2% Roman Catholic, 70% nonconformist. And then I've given you numbers for 1989, 3% Anglican, and I've given you the overall figure and sort of 9.5%. So in 1989, about 1 in 10 people were in church. That figure is less than 1 in 20 now, 2014. And Anglicanism just over 1%.
But the Anglicans have dropped the most, in the sense that the Anglicans
yep.
got half of the church attendance in 1851, and I see they're only 20%.
Yeah, half the Anglicans have dropped the most. The two denominations that have fared worse between 1989 and 2014, though, are the Roman Catholics and the Methodists. Because if you notice, in 1989, Roman Catholicism had... there's about 2 million people attended, and they're now lower than Anglicans. They're about 600,000, and Methodists have really shrunk as well. There's about, I can't remember the figures, I think this might only be about 400,000, might even be less than that, Methodism. Methodism's gone down by two-thirds.
So is the growth Muslim?
No, in terms of Christian denominations. In terms of Christian denominations, the strength, or the, I mean, if you could call it growth, holding your own. So... And we will look at this next time, or in 2 weeks' time, in a bit more detail. But the denominations that tend to, the churches that tend to hold their own tend to be independent, non-denominational. Some of the new churches. So although sort of Baptist churches have gone down, they've not gone down by as much. The three that have really suffered in the last 25 years are Anglicanism, Roman Catholicism, and Methodism. That is the ones that went a bit liberal. Anyway, we'll come on to that in a minute. Right, let's carry on. Let's crack on. So, Roman Catholicism briefly, and then that'll probably take us through to coffee. So, this is just to say what happens to Roman Catholicism in Europe, generalisations through this period. Well, go back to the French Revolution. What happened to the French Revolution? Yeah. And whose head tended to get chopped off? Yeah, which would be the nobles and the churchmen.
The clergy. The clergy come under it. Yeah, because the Roman Catholic Church in France in 1789 is the oppressor, because it's closely woven in with the state. Church and state closely woven together in France. That's why, one of the reasons why 5,000 Catholic priests are allowed into England in this period. It's to relieve them, to stop them facing the threat of death abroad. And whilst most of the other revolutions and reform movements that happen in the rest of Europe in the 19th century aren't quite so brutal as the French Revolution, you still get the general pattern of the church losing its wealth and losing its political power. Okay, so remember the medieval period, you had various archbishops who were also secular rulers. We only ever really had one in England, an obvious one, which was the Bishop of Durham, County Palatine of Durham. That's why he lived in a castle, still lives in a castle, because he was the ruler. But, in parts of what becomes Germany and elsewhere, and in Italy, you've got the Papal States, you've got the church having a lot of temporal power. That tends to go through the 19th century. So, for example, in Italy, from 1870, within a united Italy, the Papal States is no longer a big political player. The Vatican shrinks to its present size, and therefore there is a focus in this period on the shift from this generalisation from temporal power to spiritual power. That is, the Roman Catholic Church emphasises its spiritual authority because it no longer has temporal authority. You get a refocusing and a bit of reform of the clergy, and then you get some. And so, an example of that I give you is Pius IX. He spoke for 32 years, quite a big chunk of the 19th century, and various things that he does, various assertions he makes. So the first is Ineffabilis Deus, asserting the Immaculate Conception of the Virgin Mary. Okay, the Immaculate Conception is different from the Virgin Birth. The Immaculate Conception says that the Virgin Mary was born free from sin. Okay. You could argue that the reason you want to say that is to protect the sinlessness of Jesus. Because if Jesus is born of Mary and the Holy Spirit, in order for original sin not to be passed in this idea from Mary to Jesus, then Mary needs to be free from sin. If you have a certain understanding of the way in which original sin works. Because if you don't have that understanding of the way original sin works, you haven't got a problem. Okay? However, once you have said that the Virgin Mary is free from sin, and given the background in Roman Catholic devotional practices, what also are you doing? What's likely to happen with Mary?
Elevation.
Elevate her status, aren't you? To the point that in many or some within the Roman Catholic Church will even talk of Mary as co-redemptrix. She is, along with her son Jesus, redeems the world. So you've got a lot of statues, don't you? Think of the statue you see of the Virgin Mary with child. The Saviour and the Saviour's mother. Mary, the mother of God. Okay. So that's obvious. Now, at one level, all that is doing is just stating what's already been there within Roman Catholic theology. Of course, however, once the Pope speaks on it, then it passes into official dogma. And therefore you've got a big shift, a big theological shift in this period in the role of the Virgin Mary. And you can see that in the 20th century. Then you've got something like the Syllabus of Error. The Syllabus of Error basically says these are the things you should not be reading. There's a list of prescribed books and of prescribed ideas. And on that list, rationalism, liberal theology, Freemasonry, religious toleration, civil marriage, and the work of the Bible societies. It's an interesting mixture. Some of that I probably would put on the list of things that are not good for you. Others, well, I probably think the work of the Bible societies is a good idea. So it's just really interesting. But you've got this assertion of this is our Roman Catholic identity against all the things that are happening in the world in the mid-19th century, in the 1860s, that are perceived to be a problem. Rationalism, liberal theology, Freemasonry, religious toleration, civil marriage, and the work of the Bible societies. Religious toleration is a problem, of course, because at this point the Roman Catholic Church is very clear that they are the only church. And there is no salvation outside the Roman Catholic Church.
Their stance does not soften on that until after Vatican II in the 60s. And then you get the First Vatican Council, 1869 to 1870. Now that's interesting, isn't it, in itself? If you hold a council in the Vatican, who's likely to dominate proceedings? Well, of course it is, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, not accidental it's held there. And papal infallibility is strongly asserted. The Pope is infallible and beyond correction when he teaches ex cathedra on matters of faith and practice. Therefore, when the Pope chooses to speak ex cathedra, he is in his word is infallible and cannot be questioned. Which is interesting. It's interesting that a council asserts the idea that a council cannot question the Pope. But there you go. So, I mean, I'll just give you those as three examples. Just, put it this way. The Roman Catholic Church is not backing down at this point, is it? It may have lost all its temporal power in the 19th century. It may no longer be a player in quite the same way it was, but it's not going to back down in terms of its views of its own authority vis-a-vis Roman Catholics. Because, of course, all these people in France and in Italy and in Spain and all these other places that have gone through a political reformation, have gone through a political changes, they're still Roman Catholics for the most part. The church may not have any temporal power anymore, but it can assert its spiritual power. Telling you that the Pope is infallible, what you can and can't read, and continuing to assert doctrine that is, well, at best not found within the scriptures, and the idea of Mary's co-redemptrix, definitely contrary to the scriptures. The Mary of the New Testament is clearly fallible, and gets stuff wrong. We know that, don't we? I mean, that's the picture we're given. It's a very gentle picture, but she's clearly not. She, along with Jesus' brothers, thinks that he's mad at points. I think she's probably wrong. Jesus thinks she's wrong. Who do you want to go with? That's and obviously that has an impact in England and elsewhere. Obviously, there's a small number of Roman Catholics in England, but a growing number in this period. But that's where Roman Catholicism is at. So in a way, continuing to move on that same trajectory of, because we've got the Bible as our source of authority, but because we've also got tradition, with a capital T, then we will continue to assert that the tradition leads us to interpret passages in this way, and therefore this is what it is. So there isn't really, that's not a significant change from the church of the 16th century, really. You still continue to assert tradition. It's an authority question, isn't it? It's an ultimate authority question. Where is it? Go on.
I read somewhere that there was a pope in the 1920s, and I can't remember his name, but he said that he was God on earth, not God's representative, but he was God on earth.
It's possible. I don't know. I mean, yeah. And then the question is whether he was speaking ex cathedra at that point. I think the bigger picture is just where the Roman Catholic Church continues on its same trajectory as it has been on since the Council of Trent in the late 16th century theoretical equal weighting between the scriptures and tradition, but functionally the tradition always trumps scriptures when it comes to it, because the tradition interprets the scripture and decides what the scripture says. So the ultimate authority belongs to the tradition, the magisterium of the church. Now, do you see what I'm getting at there? There are various authority sources, aren't there? So you can look to tradition, you can look to reason, you can look to experience, and you can look to the scriptures. And everybody does a combination. The question comes, where does the final authority lie? Very clear within the Roman Catholic construction that final authority lies with the tradition of the church. So, any questions on that? It's just where things are up to. Bit of a survey.
Do we still have the same Bible centers at this point? Are they from James or
In England, yeah, King James. So really, it's really the 20th century you start getting the RSV and stuff. And partly because in the 19th century, people can still cope with these and thous, because they still use them a bit. So it's not such an issue.
But the Catholics on the continent,
There are, I don't know about the, the services are still in Latin. They're Latin until Vatican II, 1960s. So, the rediscovery of the Bible by Roman Catholics is really a 1960s plus thing. It's post-Vatican II. So I don't think the average Roman Catholic would have a Bible at this point, because they wouldn't need one. You're much more likely to have devotional icons and statues of Mary, you know what I mean, rather than when working it that way. Again, generalisation, but that's a different picture. Good. Shall we have a cup of tea? I'll just go make one. A physician who prescribes my diet and so on, then I have no need to exert myself. I have no need to think. If only I can pay, others will take care of that disagreeable business for me. Those guardians who have taken supervision upon themselves see to it that the overwhelming majority of mankind, among them the entire fair sex, should consider the step to maturity not only as hard, but as extremely dangerous. First, these guardians make their domestic cattle stupid and carefully prevent the zotile creatures from taking a single step without the leading strings to which they've fastened them. Then they show them the danger that threaten them, that they should try to walk by themselves. Now, this danger is really not very great. After stumbling a few times, they would at last learn to walk. However, examples of such failures intimidate and generally discourage all further attempts. Thus, it is very difficult for the individual to work himself out of the knowledge which has become almost second nature to him. He's even grown to like it and is at first really incapable of using his own understanding because he has never been permitted to try it. Dogmas and formulas, these mechanical tools designed for reasonable use, or rather abuse of his natural gifts, are the fetters of an everlasting knowledge. The man who casts them off would make an uncertain leap over the narrowest ditch because he is not used to such free movement. That is why there are only a few men who walk firmly and who have emerged from knowledge by cultivating their own minds. It is more nearly possible, however, for the public to enlighten itself. Indeed, if it is only given freedom, enlightenment is almost inevitable. There will always be a few independent thinkers, even among the self-appointed guardians of the multitude. Once such men have thrown off the yoke of knowledge, they will spread about them the spirit of a reasonable appreciation of man's value and of his duty to think for himself. It is especially to be noted that the public, which was earlier brought under the yoke by these men, afterwards forces these very guardians to remain in submission, if it is so incited by some of its guardians, who are themselves incapable of any enlightenment. That shows how pernicious it is to implant prejudices. They will eventually revenge themselves upon the authors of all their authors' descendants. Therefore, a public can achieve enlightenment only slowly. A revolution may bring about the end of a personal despotism or of avaricious tyrannical oppression, but never a true reform of modes of thought. New prejudices will serve in place of the old as guidelines for the unthinking multitude. This enlightenment requires nothing but freedom, and the most innocent of all that may be called freedom. Freedom to make public use of one's reason in all matters. Now I hear the cry from all sides, do not argue. The officers do not argue drill. The tax collector, do not argue pay. The pastor, do not argue believe. The only one ruler in the world says, argue as much as you please, but obey. We find restrictions on freedom everywhere. But which restriction is harmful to enlightenment? Which restriction is innocent? And which advances enlightenment? I reply, the public use of one's reason must be free at all times. And this alone can bring enlightenment to mankind. Now, I deliberately read that. It's quite a long extract from Kant, but I think it's quite a good one because it's a very positive view of enlightenment. So he describes enlightenment as the process of freeing yourself from the tutelage of guardians, of growing up. Yes? And that's a very positive view of enlightenment, throwing off the old, bringing on the new, and using one's reason. However, there is at the heart of Kant's argument a contradiction, because Kant wants people to throw off their guardians by following his example as a guardian. Do you notice that? Because he's offering a different path, isn't he? He's utterly convinced it's the right path, but he is still saying, isn't he, you need to be free, and therefore you need to follow this path that I am laying out for you. So as well as the officer that says, do not argue drill, the tax collector, do not argue pay, the pastor, do not argue believe, the one who says, argue as much as you please, but obey, Kant says, do not argue, use your reason. So the mechanism is the same. But it's couched in terms of self-discovery and of inevitable self-discovery if only you try and free yourself. So it's a very strong argument. It's a very effective, very plausible argument. And for most people, the inherent contradiction that lies at the heart of it is not problematic. Because it sounds like such a good argument. But I just observed that, and again, that's not to deride the achievements of the Enlightenment. There's moving outside of tyranny is a good thing, but it is just noticing the way that this argument doesn't actually do what it says it does, which is to throw off all authorities. It generates a new authority because someone has to be the arbiter of reasonableness. You have to have some definition of what's reasonable and what's not. You have to have some definition of what's free and what isn't free. Even Kant recognises the issue that you've got to say which freedoms are good and which freedoms are bad, which restrictions are innocent and which are harmful. So someone's still got to be deciding what's right and what's wrong. Do you see the issue there? And that central contradiction just carries all the way through the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment project. It's one of the reasons why when you get to the modern philosophy, it's where you get to the idea of postmodernism and the idea of rejecting Kant's view that there is a truth in favour of arguing that there are lots and lots of different truths. However, you still don't escape the basic problem because now you have a guardian saying there is not one truth, there are lots of truths. But the still question comes, well, how do you know that there are lots of truths? If there are lots of truths, how can you make a statement that there are lots of truths? Because that seems like a fairly exclusive truth. That feels like a fairly total truth claim. Anyway, do you want me to leave that there for now? Okay, I'll stop there. Anyway, but you get the flavour of the Enlightenment from that quote, don't you? This is about growing up. This is about human beings leaving childhood behind and growing up. And of course, one of the things that belongs to childhood is
innocence,
well, and religion, an adherence to religion. That's clearly part of it, isn't it? That's one of the things you've got to... Now, that's not Kant rejecting faith, per se, but it is Kant saying you need to come out from the tutelage of others and follow me. Right, and then we get various other Enlightenment thinkers that have a big impact. And I've picked these because I think they still have an impact today in terms of how we think. So, George Hegel. He thinks of God more as a process than a person. God is at work by his spirit in history. And we see this in the following way. We have a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis, and that moves us forward. Okay? So let me give you an example. The Roman Catholic Church of the early 16th century would be the thesis, that which was in Europe in that period. Along comes Martin Luther as the antithesis, attacking the Roman Catholic Church, etc., etc. And out of that you arise a new synthesis, okay, which is the religious situation in Europe in the second half of the 16th century, Protestantism. Does that make sense? In Hegel's thinking, the synthesis is always progress from the thesis. So you move from a thesis through antithesis to a synthesis, and that synthesis is progress. But, of course, progress never stops. So the Protestant church in Lutheran Germany in the 16th century is the new thesis. Well, what happens? Well, then you get Enlightenment thinking. And that's the new antithesis. And then you get a new synthesis, which includes this new thinking. And you go on, and as more and more things come along, you get a constant stream of new synthesis.
And you're always, by definition, making progress. You have to be making progress because you're moving from thesis to antithesis to synthesis. So
it's more unidimensional as that, is it? Because the synthesis doesn't replace the previous thesis, it just provides an additional thesis.
Well, no, it should, the antithesis challenges the thesis and the synthesis is supposed to replace.
In
reality...
For example, it didn't. It just added to it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, but the progress is in the synthesis. So you chart progress through the synthesis, so that you'll always end up with that which is old and passing away. But if you want to know where the good is, it's the progress. The Hegelian thing doesn't work, but it's still a powerful thought because it still drives a lot of the way we think in terms of progress. Moving from the old to the new is moving from the bad to the better. You know, why do washing powders say new improved? Because there's a thesis that this is a good washing powder. We discover something it doesn't do, which provides a new... Now, it's not to say they're not new improved. I'm just saying the argument of new improved works with us, doesn't it? Because the appeal to progress is a strong appeal. So I agree with you. The Hegelian thing sort of breaks down, and most people would never structure it like he does, but you still will hear people say, well, you know, we've moved on from that now, haven't we? That's an argument you can run. We've moved past that. We don't believe that anymore. We used to think that, but now this new situation comes along, and therefore we have to do things differently. I'm not saying that's always a wrong thing to say. You know, if you're designing jet engines, changing your design as a result of new information is probably a good thing. Okay. But that doesn't mean it necessarily applies to the whole of life. But Hegel has this whole historical process. I think the power of it is the fact that the new is, by being new, is better than the old. And that's the effect.
Coming back to your washing powder thing,
mm-hmm.
Are we not being counseled by the advertising people?
Well, that's another way of thinking about it, but I'm just noting the way in which the new improved is an effective argument. It's a baseline effective way of describing something, isn't it? If you can say something is new improved, most of us don't think, well, I don't like the new, I prefer the old. Most of us think, oh, new. Preferring the old.
Most of us think.
Yeah, but that's our point of suspicion, isn't it? The basic idea that something is new, that's, you know, we've got a new design, the implication is it's better. Otherwise, why would you have a new one? Yeah. I take all your caveats about advertising, but do you see the basic strength of the core argument? And still an effective argument today.
Yeah.
You know, a new way of doing things is generally, you know, why did Tony Blair come along and describe labour as new labour? The implication being is that it was new and better than what had gone before. A new synthesis. I don't want to get into whether it was or not. Let's not get into that. We all want to go home in 25 minutes. Okay. So the other element of this that I think it remains important is Schleiermacher. This is Romanticism, okay? I've given you his name because there's no chance of spelling it. He was a minister, Protestant minister, and you know, really famous, sort of national hero figure within Germany in the early 19th century. And he responds to rationalism and the way in which in the 18th century rationalism is just cutting everything away and seeming to leave nothing left historically of the sort of the Bible, because it's not rational. You've got this closed universe, you've not got any miracles, etc., etc. He deals with that by saying, well, it doesn't matter about that, don't worry about that. We're not worried about historical details. What we're worried about is the essence of religion as the sense of something infinite. Okay? So he talks a lot about God consciousness, and he talks about the sense of absolute dependence on God. So this fits with the kind of romanticism that you see developing in the late 18th century, where It's a reaction against the rationalist universe, which is a closed system, and that everything has to be, we have to be able to understand everything and reason it out, or it doesn't exist. But Romanticism is a reaction against that, but reacts within that worldview. So it effectively says, well, I know we can't prove it doesn't exist, but that doesn't matter. It's sort of ineffable, and it's how we feel about things. And he brings that into theology very strongly, very effectively. Talks about intuition and feeling being at the heart of religion. Okay, so it's not about the facts. There wasn't worry about whether or not these are historical works, whether or not this actually happened. It's about our response to our sense of God that we get when we read the New Testament or when we pray or whatever. Okay, now that I think is another powerful thought that continues to have an impact to this day, isn't it? For a lot of people who aren't religious, religion is in the non-factual reader response feelings realm of things, the unreal. It's like any hobbies. It's a leisure pastime. It doesn't really matter. But if that's what you want to do, then fine, as long as you don't let it affect your secular decision making. So that's one of the things that we bequeath from Schleiermacher, is that willingness to put religion in the kind of the feelings only category, but it's not a rational thing. Make sense? Does that you know? There's quite a lot of that within Christianity, isn't there? What are you thinking like that? And this all starts to feed into the stuff in the 19th century. So let me give you some examples. So you've got the Tübingen school. F.C. Bauer, I've given you him, is a very famous biblical critic. And he has this Hegelian view of history, that the old is less developed than the new. And the new is a development. So he has this idea that in the New Testament you see a struggle between Peter and Paul. Between Peter's very Jewish religion and Paul's sort of law-free Gentile religion. Therefore you've got this whole thesis, antithesis, and then you have a new synthesis that you see after the New Testament. He develops this idea. Okay, it's just an example of that kind of Hegelian thing in view. I mean, his argument is disproved very soon afterwards by an English biblical critic called Lightfoot. But you know, why let the truth get in the way of a good idea? So Bauer. Then you've got David Strauss. His Life of Jesus. He's doing this is the sort of classic liberal project. You're trying to remake this in the light of the new situation. So he's anti-supernatural, which means you have to get rid of miracles. That means you get rid of most of the Gospels. He reckons with some contradictions in the virgin birth. And he says that the significance of the Gospel stories lies not in their historical truth, but in terms of what they tell us, that they tell us true things. Okay? So the stories become not historical events, but vehicles for meaning. The trouble with that, of course, is that once you've taken the historicity away from the event, then you've also taken away the effective control on what the meaning is. I'll give you an example. It's a fairly modern example, and I was assured by Dave this morning that someone had heard this interpretation within the last year, one of his church members at a different church. Feeding the 5,000, okay? If the feeding of the 5,000 is a historical event that happened to Jesus, then there is a control on what it's about. It must be about Jesus' supernatural power. Can't not be, can it? Okay? And it must be about Jesus being the new Moses, God himself, can do what God can do, and therefore that's what the story is about. However, if it didn't happen, if the historicity is questionable and we're not sure about miracles, then what is the feeding the 5,000 a story about? Well, you have to work it out for yourself, don't you? Because it can't be about what it looks like it's about, because miracles don't happen. So what is the feeding the 5,000 about? Is it perhaps a story about sharing? Little boy gets his lunch out. Everybody else feels a bit guilty, gets their lunch out too. I've heard it expressed a story about that. But maybe it's a story about something else. I don't know. It doesn't really matter, does it? Because there's no control. There's no way of saying that's a wrong interpretation. Because the interpretation, rather than being seated in the text and what the text is saying, is seated in the response of the reader to the text. And that's where meaning resides. Does that make sense? So see these shifts. These are quite significant shifts in terms of how you interpret the scriptures and what you do with them. And very much alive and kicking today in our churches. And then Wellhausen, I've just given you as a final example, he follows this development process in the Pentateuch, finds various sources there, J, E, P and D, and those sources are often not at one. So rather than the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, being a unitary account of God's working with his people, in Wellhausen's scheme, they become a competing set of sources where various authors are trying to get the upper hand over other authors. Well, of course, once they're that, then that completely changes their meaning, doesn't it? Their meaning is not self-evident. You have to take them apart. You have to get behind the text, take the text apart, and then reconstruct it and reconstruct a new meaning there. Which as we might describe it in postmodern terms, is a bit of a power grab, isn't it? And definitely puts the interpreter in authority over the text, because the interpreter is deciding what the text actually is doing. Happy or not happy? Does it all make sense? Okay. So if you've noticed so far, that's all German. Okay. And it's known as German higher criticism. But it makes its way into England. And by the middle of the 19th century, it's made its way into England. And there's a couple of big things that you see that indicate the fact. The first is this book, Essays and Reviews. Now, I've given you the contents of Essays and Reviews. There are seven authors of Essays and Reviews. Six of them are clergy. And in this book, they say, they talk about universalism. That's pretty much getting rid of, well, it gets rid of hell, universalism, doesn't it? The church is the moral conscience of the state. They talk about, this is a lovely little line, isn't it? The Bible is authority to the child, example to youth, and guide to the mature. Okay? That actually our consciences are supreme arbiter of truth, not the scriptures. Because the scriptures, once you've taken them apart with German higher criticism, the scriptures are in error. So you can't trust them, because the author's got it wrong. So the only thing you can trust is yourself. And various other things there, all tending in that direction. So that's where you get to. Remember that the idea of liberalism is not you get rid of everything, it's just that you remake it. The remaking here is effectively removing the authority of the scriptures and rooting the authority in the interpreter and in the interpretive community that now can tell us with certainty the assured results of modern scholarship. In my field, in New Testament studies, the assured results of modern scholarship is a slight comedy term that you use, because we've all read it so many times and then discovered a few years later that those assured results of modern scholarship weren't true anymore. In other fields, there's probably a similar phrase. You know the kind of thing. It's usually people say, we all think this. We all know that this is true. And then we discover 5 years later it's not. But that's the kind of thing you're doing. The interpretive community becomes the authority. And therefore, the scriptures can't be trusted. Then you get Lux Mundi in 1889. The thing about Lux Mundi is that here you get two strands joined together. You get the kind of liberalism of Essays and Reviews, but you also get a sort of the ritualism of the Anglo-Catholic movement coming together in what becomes known as liberal Catholicism, which is, you know, one of the most dominant theological streams in the Church of England to this day. And there you get Charles Gore, who becomes a bishop in 1901, who writes in Lux Mundi with various other authors. Things like, the Old Testament is incomplete and only selectively inspired. And because Jesus thought the Old Testament was true, he was in error. But don't worry, that error was only in his human nature. If you can make that division. Most of the early Trinitarian theologians would struggle with that, I think. And that other scriptural authors also err in historical fact. So the Bible just has errors in it. And therefore people need to tell us where the errors are. Which means, of course, that those who are telling us where the errors are the ones who are in authority over the document. Because we need them to tell us what's right and what's wrong. And that's just you generate a new authority. So here's Charles Gore's preface to Lux Mundi. Gives you an example of this. For this collection of essays represents an attempt on behalf of the Christian creed in the way of explanation.
We are sure that Jesus Christ is still and will continue to be the light of the world. Next Monday. We are sure that if men can rid themselves of prejudice and mistakes, for which it must be said the church is often as responsible as they, and will look afresh at what the Christian faith really means, they will find that it is as adequate as ever to interpret life and knowledge in its several departments and to impart not less intellectual than moral freedom. But we are conscious also that if the true meaning of the faith is to be made sufficiently conspicuous, it means disencumbering, reinterpreting, and explaining. Which sounds lovely. Of course, the disencumbering is often disencumbering from those bits of the Bible that we don't like anymore. The reinterpreting is reinterpreting of those the bits of the Bible that we are left, and the explaining is very often explaining away things like miracles. Because we're in a new situation, and people can't believe this stuff anymore, and therefore everything needs to change. Does that sound at all familiar to anybody? Okay. This project is alive and well. The John Revell thing, I won't do too, just got a sort of a useful summary of what liberalism is. The one question I want to pose is whether liberalism as a core mission strategy has been effective. And that's why I've given you that little table at the bottom of page 5. So what are we talking? Second half of the 19th century is when liberalism really starts to hold sway within the Church of England. And how does that go? Well, we move from, particularly within Anglicanism, we move from having a 20% attendance in 1851 to 3% in 1989. And just over 1% in 2014. All the time, we are continually told, aren't we, that the church needs to adjust to the new situation. Well, that adjustment to the new situation has not been a terribly successful mission strategy for the last 150 years. Because it's not like our church is full of people, is it?
I mean, earlier you said a lot of people left the church because it was
yeah. Are high, yeah, they're high, but I think I'd still think that that 3% figure you've got by 1989 is well past the period where people went to a church out of obligation, and you've still gone from 3% in 1989 to 1% in 2014. So even if you don't, I'm going to take your point. Even if you don't go all the way back to 1851, you're not dealing with a successful mission strategy, and you can see that's not. You can see it's not successful if you look at the figures, because the three denominations that have suffered most between 1889 and 2014, we'll come back to these figures in a couple of weeks' time, are Methodists, Anglicans, and Roman Catholics. Roman Catholics have suffered for slightly different reasons, but certainly the Methodists and Anglicans of the denominations listed, they're the ones with most liberal churches. It hasn't been a terribly effective strategy for obvious reasons. Any questions on that? Does that make sense? Does that sound vaguely familiar? I mean, it should do. That is a lot. You know, it is a lot of what you read and hear about sort of Christianity in general. We need to move with the times.
So, James, when you say liberal churches, do you mean liberal in the sense that you just
did? Yes, I mean liberal in the sense of having a teaching ministry which has largely rejected the biblical authority and has accepted that you need to root faith not in what the scriptures say but in how you respond to God based on either what the scriptures say with tweaks because you can't rely on all of it or just another source. We'll come back to some of this stuff, but I just want to flag up. This is where we start to move, I think, into our setting theologically. That's all terribly depressing, so let's cheer ourselves up with a bit of J.C. Ryle. And I've given you J.C. Ryle's dates and information. I did not know until I looked yesterday and discovered that he was the daughter of Susanna. Daughter of Charles Hunt of Worksworth, Derbyshire. Of Worksworth, almost one of our own. Macclesfield's practically in Derbyshire anyway, isn't it? So there we are. You can claim J.C. Ryle as
as a good Derbyshire lad by association. Quite possibly. Well, Charles Hirt was a would have probably been a man of wealth, because certainly John Ryle, private banker, was. So he was educated at Eton and the University of Oxford, and then he was going to go into becoming an MP, but his father was bankrupted, and therefore he had to settle for holy orders instead. But it worked out okay for him, and then you've got his church career there, long stay at Helmingham in Suffolk, for 17 years as vicar there, and then obviously became Dean of Salisbury and almost instantly Bishop of Liverpool. Three marriages, sadly two of his wives died young. That's just basic biography. I've given you a list of his key longer works. But what I want to look at is, I'm just going to read to you for the last 8 minutes from one of his pieces. I'm not going to read the first one, which is The Teaching of the Ritualists, Not the Teaching of the Church of England. But I'll read you the second, starting on page 7, which is What Do We Owe to the Reformation? This is available, by the way, on the Church of on the Church Society website, because the Church Association and Church Society have the same roots. I think Church Association joins with other groups and becomes Church Society. And it's actually quite a readable, because I've not given you the whole thing at all. So what do we owe to the Reformation? Our lot is cast in days when it is the fashion to despise everything that is old. There is a morbid readiness to throw aside all things which bear about them the least mark of antiquity, and to treat them with as little respect as last year's almanacs or worn-out clothes. The only exceptions I can think of are old lace, old coins, old pictures and old wine. But as a general rule, old opinions and old institutions are too often condemned as useless lumber and shovelled out of the way simply because they are old. Now, I am not one of those who object to all changes and reforms of old things. Nothing of the kind. I heartily thank God for most of the changes of the last half century, whether political or social or scientific or educational. I should not be an honest man if I did not declare my conviction that on the whole they are great improvements. But there is one subject about which I cannot take up new views, and that subject is the English Reformation. I cannot agree with those who now tell us that the Reformation was a blunder, and that the reforms are overpraised, that Protestantism has done this country no good, and that it would matter little if England placed her neck once more under the foot of the Pope of Rome. Against these newfangled opinions, I enter my solemn protest. I want no departure from the old Protestant paths, which were cast up by Cranmer, Ridley and Latimer 300 years ago. In short, about the value of the English Reformation, I want no new views. I unhesitatingly maintain that the old are better. Next paragraph is all about what he's planning to do. And you can see in that last line that goes, that's in capitals, we owe an enormous debt to the Protestant Reformation. So picking this up, bottom of page 8, let me clear the way by saying that I do not pretend to endorse the character of all the agents by whom the English Reformation was carried out, or to approve of everything which they did. I do not for a moment maintain that Henry VIII was a godly man. No, too often he was a brutal tyrant. I do not say that the statesmen who surrounded him were faultless characters, far from it. Too many of them made a market of the Reformation and enriched their families by plundering abbey lands. I do not ask you to believe that Cranmer and the other reformers, either in the days of Henry VIII or Edward VI or Elizabeth, were angels and made no mistakes. I frankly admit that they did some things which they ought not to have done, and left undone some things which they ought to have done. If that sounds familiar. But you must remember that God does a great deal of good work with very imperfect tools, sorry about that, such as Sennacherib and Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus. All I do maintain is that the whole result of the Protestant Reformation was enormous gain to this country, and I confidently assert that England before the Reformation was as unlike England after the Reformation as black and white, darkness and light, night and day. Facts, stubborn facts, exist to prove the correctness of this assertion, and some of these facts I shall try to bring before you. He then goes through for the next sort of 14 or 15 pages what the church was like before the Reformation and why the Reformation was an improvement. And then he comes to his conclusion, and I think his conclusion is interesting for where we are and how we view the Church of England today. Let me now conclude all I have to say with a few pieces of plain practical advice. One, for one thing, I advise you to resist manfully the efforts now being made to un-Protestantise England
and to bring her once more into subject and popery. Let us not go back to ignorance, superstition, priestcraft and immorality. Our forefathers tried popery long ago and threw it off with disgust and indignation. Let us not put the clock back and return to Egypt. Let us have no peace with Rome till Rome abjures her errors and is at peace with Christ. All these paragraphs go on a little bit longer than I've given you. Second, for another thing, I charge you to beware of ritualism and to do all that you can to resist it. Ritualism is the high road to Rome, and the triumph of ritualism will be the restoration of popery. Resist it in little things. Resist strange dresses, sacrificial garments, the Easter position in consecrating the bread and the wine, idolatrous reverence of the consecrated elements, processions, banners, incense, candles on the communion table, turning to the East, crosses at the East, and extravagant church decorations. Resist them manfully. They seem trifles, but they frequently lead to a great deal of mischief, and they often end in downright popery. Okay. Those two pieces of advice are probably more with his context, although I think I would still endorse what he says in paragraph two in terms of how we do church architect, but we're not going to open up the church architecture discussion again tonight. Let's leave that one be for now. Three and four, however, very contemporary pieces of advice. My third piece of advice is this. Do not be in a hurry to leave the Church of England because many of her clergy are unfaithful. It is a cheap and easy policy for churchmen to shirk trouble and run away in the hour of conflict, but it is neither manly nor Christian nor kind. It is a shortcut road out of difficulties to launch the longboat when the good ship is in jeopardy and to leave your comrades to sink. But it is not the line of action that which becomes an Englishman. As Nelson said at Trafalgar, England expects every man to do his duty, and so does the Church of England expect every Protestant churchman to do his duty and stick by the ship. Away with this talk about cessation. Away with this flirting with Plymouth Brethrenism. Let us not play the enemy's game by deserting the good old fortress, so long as the articles are unchanged and the pulpit is unfettered. Interesting, those two things that Ryle thinks are essential. My fourth and last piece of advice is this. Work everyone, both publicly and privately, and work hard for the defence of Christ's truth and the maintenance of Reformation principles in the Church of England. But work together in an organised and systematic way, or else you will do very little. Men with muskets do not make an army, as the French found to their cost in the late Franco-German War. An evangelical churchman without organisation will do but little in opposing ritualism. Associate, unite, organise, work together, keep together, and much may be done. Work charitably and kindly, and make allowance for the utter ignorance in which many ritualists live of the real nature of evangelical principles. Now, you never left in any doubt what Ryle thinks, which is always nice. But I think it is interesting how much what? Well, that was probably written mid-1870s. The late Franco-German War is 1870. So you're talking mid-1870s. So what's that? Getting on for 150 years ago, 140-odd years ago. And yet, whilst the issue may have changed, and if I was writing that now, it would be liberalism, not ritualism, that I would worry about, although very often the liberalism and the ritualism go together. But that's another conversation. But it's noticeable how much of that still remains advice worthy of reflection in terms of the present state of the Church of England. It's interesting that Ryle, just after peak oil, when there's 5.2 million people going to the Anglican Church every week, would still look around him a few years later and say, things are not all as they should be. But don't go. Don't desert. Keep fighting whilst the articles remain and the pulpit is unfettered.
What does that mean?
It means that you can preach freely the gospel. So, our pulpit is currently unfettered because I am free to preach the gospel without restraint. And the articles have not changed. There's a problem with the pulpit being unfettered in the sense that everybody gets to say whatever they like, but the positive of us is that the only people I'm going to get a phone call about my preaching from is from the police if I happen to say the wrong thing about certain subjects or say it not in a sufficiently careful way, which is one of the reasons I don't make transcripts available. So no one can maliciously try and misinterpret what I'm saying. Cut it and slice it and make it say something else. But that's the world we live in. But I would still say that our pulpits are unfettered.
And the 39 Articles are still the official teaching of the Church of England. I think those are two. I think I'm happy with those two as guides, whilst those two things remain. Church of England's always been a bit of a mixed bag, but there we are. Any questions on that? Yeah. Yeah. It is, yeah. So there's two types. Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, you know, that's a lot of people's experience of church, isn't it? I think it's fair to say that I don't think Duff has ever been a high church, has it?
No, it always prided itself on being low.
But there are still some things that have shifted since I arrived that I would, you know, my nose for ritualism is perhaps more sensitive than others. The cathedrals pride themselves on being high church, yeah. Yeah, I bet you do. Good. J.C. Rowell, I think, is a good read. Trace up some more of those tracts on the Church Society website. I think he remains a good author and actually quite accessible still. His style is well written. It's an accessible style. So even at 150 years old, he's one of the easier authors to read. Should we stop there? It's probably enough for tonight, isn't it? And we'll carry on next week.